Well, now, thank you very much indeed. We're going to move on to the panel session. I'm going to invite Brendan Barber, the General Secretary of the TUC, to introduce himself and his take on all of this in just 4 or 5 minutes, and then I'll invite Lynn Sedgemoor from the Executive Director of the 157 Group to do the same, and then we'll take your questions and dialogue until the coffee break. So, Brendan, good morning.
Good morning, Willie, and thanks very much indeed for the opportunity to offer some thoughts from a TUC perspective. And I really just want to make 3 points very briefly in this opening contribution. And the first point is that there's never been more need to invest in skills. The recession has underlined the structural weaknesses that we've got in the British economy, and we won't deliver a sustainable recovery without a revolution in workforce skills. Now, we welcome the initiatives from government, for example, on apprenticeships and its related emphasis on rebuilding our technical and intermediate skills base. But with 1 in 5 under 25s without work, including half of black youngsters in the country, we've got to do even more to provide opportunities to the workers of tomorrow. And with the country facing some significant industrial restructuring, Willie, as your remarks there about the prospects for the construction industry remind us, as we reduce our overdependence on financial services and prepare for the low carbon age, we've also got to upskill and reskill the workers of today. And as the Commission research has shown, companies that maintain investment in skills during the recession will be far better placed to take advantage of the recovery when it comes. So to my second point, and that is we've got to do more to meet the needs of individuals. A demand-led approach to skills is all well and good, provided it applies to workers as well as to businesses. And we think that there is a huge unmet demand among working people for access to higher skills. And with a third of employers still failing to train their staff, we must ensure that we have the right framework in place to meet this need. So that's why we strongly campaigned for the forthcoming right to request time to train alongside the proposed skills account. And that's why we in the trade union movement are doing an increasing amount of work looking to take learning and to lift the ambitions of ordinary workers. And through our specialist learning organisation, Union Learn, we now have a network of around 24,000 trade union learning representatives in workplaces of all sorts across the British economy that last year helped around 250,000 individuals to access new opportunities as a result of union initiatives. Everything from skills to life to higher level degree provision. And time and again, we've seen that it's union learning reps that can actually reach people that other parts of the education and learning system have not been able to reach, encouraging employers to make new opportunities available, brokering arrangements often with local colleges and providers, and absolutely crucially, giving individuals the confidence to have another go at learning, people who had often felt themselves written off by the formal education system. So to my third and final point, and that is that we need to drive up employer investment in skills. Now, we've welcomed the latest skills strategy from government, which underpins the new emphasis on industrial activism and the National Skills Audit being conducted by the Commission, SSCs and RDAs. But with the public finances stretched as never before and real cuts looming in education and skills budgets, we need to ensure that employers play their part and especially if we're to achieve the step change in the crucial area of green skills. And as the Commission report towards Ambition 2020 reminded us, we start from a pretty low base, with around a quarter of employers that have never, ever invested in the skills of their workforce. So that's why we need to think about how can we use other mechanisms to lever new employer investment, public procurement, for example, to begin to really drive that change in culture that we need to see. So there's a lot for us to be thinking about, and Willie, as Britain emerges from recession towards recovery, let's make sure that all of us play our part in delivering the opportunities that this country needs. Thank you very much indeed, Brendan.
Lynn, would you like to offer us some perspectives on this? Lynn, as you'll know from the biography, has worked in the learning and training industry and now specialises enormously in the development of leadership and leadership skills. Lynn?
I would. I'm going to speak on behalf from the perspective of colleges. Yes, I'm from the 157 group, which is 30 of the large urban colleges, but I want to speak more broadly on behalf of all colleges. The messages that we've been hearing, empowering customers, focusing on outcomes, colleges as key assets, transparency, accountability, new forms of incentives, and I think most importantly for colleges, trusting providers, are actually aspects and elements that colleges have been asking for and campaigning on for a very long time. I've been in the system for 30 years now. That's not in any way to detract from the critical messages that the Commission is giving in their report, but more to support it. It's music to our ears, and I want to be very positive. Professor David Feingold, as you all, there was a frisson as he talked about Britain looking at things half empty, didn't he? And I think trust is related to theory Y management, where you actually believe that people can get on and do it if you give them the environment. Fear and half empty glasses are linked with theory X management, which I think is mostly what happens certainly from the centre in this country around believing that you have to micromanage and account for every single thing in order for things to be successful. The thing I learnt most yesterday or got real evidence for is how countries such as Australia, Singapore and New Zealand and Canada, who've already tackled their fiscal challenges and taken radical measures in simplification, reducing intermediaries, less control, less inspection or regulation mechanisms, far from having weakened performance, are actually doing better than those countries who haven't actually tackled those issues yet. And in response to David Feingold last night, Professor Ewart Keep actually said, because he was named on the slot this morning about being particularly good at a glass half empty, was that his response was, it's what is in the glass that actually matters and what it tastes like. And I think what we've got at the moment is a report and expert advice from the Commission that's actually a very tasty set of drinks in the glass with lots of useful ingredients. What we do, 157 have strongly welcomed the proposals because for the first time what we've got is a system-wide analysis and perspective of holding in place and to account and marking the role of every aspect of the skills system. It's got a dynamic and challenging vision. This broader systems view of individuals, employers, the supply organisations working in synergy. I think the most important thing is a philosophical and cultural shift about high trust, transparency, and really, I think, as Charles was saying earlier, getting to the nub of what it means to be customer-focused, customer-led, and allowing the system to drive itself from that viewpoint, which I think we're not yet good at in the public service. Moving from a top-down, tightly controlled measurement system. And indeed, one of the sentences that we welcome is colleges need to grow, not to diminish. So in response to that, what do colleges and other training providers need to do to raise our game? We are all very, very strongly saying we want to embrace this food course labelling proposal. Colleges are stepping forward to radically experiment in pilots, AOC, ALP, and 157 are really stepping up to that to really see how that can work, because that is a fundamental element of making it different. We know we have to continue to reinvent ourselves with employers and sector skills councils, RDAs and the CBI, to drop all our defensiveness. There's excellent good practice in college, but it's time to drop any form of defensiveness and to say, we're in this with you. How can we improve, raise our game and do even more and better work? It was interesting listening to Charles. I've just come back from 3 weeks in India, and that role, and I've been watching the programme about the slum in Mumbai, but in many ways, colleges are also civic and social community assets, not just skills players. And we play a similar role with local disadvantaged communities for individuals, unemployed, dislocated human beings, in which that lack of confidence, that need to reinvent themselves, and perhaps we need a reality show on the work of colleges to really bring that home, but we play a vital role there. Colleges are repositioning themselves as major strategic players in localities. A theme that came out yesterday in every country was that balance between a top-down policy-led system and one in which the localities and the agencies and the people involved in solving wicked, difficult, complex issues are ahead often of the understanding of the policymakers and how that can come together. One of the things that colleges have to do to rise to the demands and the implications of the Commission report is actually reconfigure themselves radically in structural and business and governance models. And 157 has just produced a document with Eversheds called Preparing Colleges for the Future, which is very much saying how can we have very different business organisational structures and forms to be far more agile and responsive as part of the new system. And lastly, we do know that we need to do more on less, and we can only do that in partnership with employers, with sector skills councils, and with the individuals who ultimately are the ones we're there to serve. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Lynn. And again, reconfirmation, if you like, reaffirmation of some key messages from yesterday. Well, now, we've got time for questions and dialogue. Just, again, a reminder about the way we'll do this. We've got microphones to get a question asked. Raise your hand when it comes to you. Would you please stand up if you're able to, so that we can catch you on the camera, and tell us who you are and where you come from? And there's a whole knot of questions here, so let's go to our first questioner, and good morning to you.
Good morning. Francis Green from University of Kent and Institute of Education. I'd like to ask the panel to address the very present conjuncture of very high youth unemployment. And in that context, the news this morning about this essential paradox that very large numbers of people, many from your colleges, are being applying to university, and at the same time, the money's been cut for the universities, so there's going to be a large amount of unmet demand. I know this is a very kind of immediate issue, and we're talking about more long-term strategic things, but it seems to me there's only 10 years till 2020, and there seems to be something deeply paradoxical. What does the panel think about that?
Thank you very much. Let's take another one, and then we'll... I see a hand up there in the bright light. Good morning.
Yes, okay. Mike Hopkins, Welsh Assembly Government. Question is,
Does the panel believe that growth is sustainable on a planet where resources are clearly finite and where the ecology of that planet is threatened? And likewise, allied with that, is human prosperity available, and I mean that at an individual and a collective level, is that prosperity available without growth?
Thank you very much. I think I might go to Charlie first of all, because he was telling me some time back about some of the perspectives that the John Lewis Partnership has on the coming years in this country. Charlie, would you like to pick up some of the issues there?
Yes. I think the first question was sort of two parts to it, really. I mean, youth unemployment, I think, is clearly a critical issue. And I think, you know, what people are increasingly aware of is just the pressing urgency of trying to avoid a repeat of what we saw in the last big recession, where we had a large group of people who were unemployed for a very long time. In terms of what can be done about that, I think it's clearly a huge political priority. I think we have to match up people having the right skills with the right jobs, and there needs to be urgent action on that front. I do think that long term, it can only really be solved by getting the economy back into growth again and taking the right measures to do so. But I do also think that businesses can play a key part. And we've recently opened a shop, for example, in Cardiff, a John Lewis shop. We've created about 700 jobs there. And we very actively went out to recruit from the long-term unemployed, not necessarily the youth unemployed, but the long-term unemployed in that instance. And we managed to recruit over 100 of those people directly from that population by working closely with Job Centre Plus. And indeed, the same sort of stories applies to Waitrose. In terms of money for university funding, I think one of the great challenges we have is there will almost certainly need to be public cuts in public expenditure. The books don't balance, and so what any government's going to have to do is to pick its way carefully through that. My personal view is that we need to see a long-term approach to the skills challenge. This is not something which is going to be answered in the space of a few years. It's going to only be answered over a long time. And my great hope is that what we will see is a longer-term strategy for a number of things, economic renewal, but also the skills and the education that are needed to support that. And then the funding should then be channeled accordingly. Shall I pause there, or do you want to go on to the green?
Yes, we'll pick up the green and sustainable question after. Others who want to comment on the youth unemployment challenge, which is so huge, and the 23% increase in university applications, which itself is massive, Lynn?
I think there's a range of initiatives that's trying to deal with youth unemployment, and we as a group have put some proposals to Yvette Cooper and Lord Mandelson about the role of FE in terms of full-time funding for places. I think the key is actually keeping young people either in some form of employment and or skills training development, or partially parts of that, so that they don't drop out of the system. So many initiatives on that. The cuts to universities, it may be useful to know that FE colleges are currently experiencing a 15% cut in their budgets, which hasn't had anywhere near the same publicity. I think part of that is because we're used to 3% year-on-year cuts, and we understand that that's important. But it does have to be a long-term game about overall that these efficiencies are made. We do have to do more on less. So I think universities need to look at the ways in which, like FE, they can adapt to some of those efficiencies without affecting the frontline services. But I think overall, again, it's a systems issue that we have to work together to make sure that over the long haul, those initiatives tackle the youth unemployment. But basically, we have to make sure that the frontline and students are not affected until absolute extremities of savings. But already, it looks like they will be. So I think that's an important issue to campaign on.
Let's hear a word or two on this from Brendan and then from Michael, then we'll move on.
Yeah, just very briefly, Willie. I mean, Charlie's absolutely right, I think, to say that what we mustn't do is to repeat the mistakes of previous recessions, where, in a sense, there was a hands-off approach and a degree of resignation that unemployment simply had to take its course, whatever the consequences. And I think it's hugely important that The government has responded actively, a range of different initiatives, the Future Jobs Fund, for example, and in particular, the response I particularly wanted to highlight, just the concept of a guarantee that young people who've been out of work for 6 months must be given an opportunity to get back into the labour market or get their first foothold in the labour market with a decent quality opportunity. Now, we're at the early days of, in a sense, the implementation and delivery of that objective, but that does seem to me to be a hugely important objective as a part of the response.
Thank you. Michael?
All I would do is highlight the reference that Charlie made earlier on, which this is one system, and that one system has employers, individuals, and providers. And because there isn't going to be more money, and in all probability there will be less money, then it's looking across that one system to see how you get those efficiency savings. So we need to think about different types of learning opportunity, and I think that particularly applies in terms of higher education. So if we can only see the creation of learning opportunities as full-time, sort of full-fat delivery, both at further and higher education, then there isn't enough money to go around. But if we could start thinking more about part-time learning opportunities, about working with employers, and I think we can get the money that we've got to move around. And to underline what Brendan said about the youth guarantee, so if we make a clear commitment to individuals that that's what we're going to do, and then everyone else then has to step up, employers and providers, to support that.
Thank you. Now let's see which panellist would like to have a go at the sustainability question. Maybe just one panellist on this one, and then you can pursue it at Speaker's Corner during the tea break. Volunteer?
I'll say what a lot of the people in the room will feel, but I mean, obviously the climate change challenge is, again, one of the great, great challenges of our time, and it's going to be that way for, I think, decades to come. What that means and what it means for business and for society, I think, are absolutely huge, and we don't really appreciate quite the magnitude and the scale of the changes that are going to be necessary for prosperity to be sustained. You asked the question about is human prosperity possible without growth? I think it's harder without growth. And indeed, if you look over the long term, you know, economies generally have found ways to grow within the limits of the resources available to them. My own belief is that if we get ingenuity and effort and money focused on this problem, then we can make significant inroads into it. I don't know how much that can be the case, but I do think there are possibilities. And in our business, I'm actually been quite encouraged by some of the initiatives that we're beginning to really grapple with. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is we're a growing business. We have ambitions to double the size of the partnership over the next 10 years, we're going to open more shops. I believe, to be a responsible business, we also have to commit to making not just a relative reduction in carbon emission, but actually probably an absolute reduction in spite of growth. So just to sort of unpick that for you, if you're going to open another 10 Waitrose supermarkets, we've actually got to find a way to operate those, not just with a 10% reduction or a 20% reduction in carbon emissions, but a huge reduction. And so you actually have to start being far more innovative about how you might go about it. And we're looking at ways of actually taking those off the grid completely so that they can genuinely be emitting hardly any carbon at all. And there are technologies beginning to emerge which could allow us to achieve that.
I was in Stornoway in the Isle of Lewis on Friday meeting 30 people who were working there in the research and development end of zero carbon economies, and it was utterly fascinating to discover that within 5 years any new building, let's say an office block or a Waitrose store, will not only be required to be carbon free, but will probably become its own power station generating renewable energy for its neighbouring community. In other words, consuming nothing but being a provider of green energy for its neighbourhood. And this, I think, is going to become commonplace. I'm not a specialist in this, but I think it's such a profound change in everything that we've grown up with for 150 years that it will itself lead to massive inventions and creativity, and it could fuel a whole new knowledge-based sector for our economy. But it is interesting that in every corner of the country there are people working on that new agenda now. Time for one or two more. Let me see if I can see any hands further up behind, in the shadows of the back. Not necessarily, but down here we are, just to the next to the camera there, and one other one along here, right in the middle. Let's get the microphones to both of you. Good morning.
My name is Matthew Crichton. I work in Edinburgh. My job title is the Job Strategy Manager, and in relation to employment and employability, we're one of the pathfinders for the DWP in terms of the localisation agenda, which basically it says that people's experience in relation to employment and the services helps to help them get work, and similarly for employers, is all experienced locally, and therefore if you want it to be joined up, it's got to be joined up locally as well. And so I'd really like to ask the panellists and the Commission whether a similar line of thought applies in the skills area. Are we going to empower cities and local areas to bring all these services together in a coherent way? Or is this coordination expected simply to come down from on top? We have a very centralised way of doing things in Britain. Or is the Commission seeking to push out also a more localised approach?
Thanks, Matthew. And good morning to you, sir.
David Feingold from Rutgers. Just a question for the whole panel, but particularly for Charlie and Brendan. I'm curious, we have some of the top researchers in the world at my school focused on employee ownership and shareholder capitalism, and their work confirms what you said, Charlie, which is when you combine strong employee ownership with training and with empowerment and team-based work, that you get dramatically better business results. My two-part question is, one, why haven't we seen the market realizing this and more organizations emulating the John Lewis model? And secondly, I guess from a policy perspective, a big theme of yesterday was the demand side, the number of British employers that are not doing best practices or high-performance work. Could we use the wealth that's in worker pensions throughout the country to forcibly move enterprises more in this way and adopt this way that would benefit both the employees, the skills, but also the returns long term?
Thank you very much. Let's ask Michael and possibly Lynn to comment on the first question, and Charlie and Brendan on the second. Michael?
So in terms of a localised approach, as we've sought to identify, the delivery of employment and skills does have an important role in terms of that local delivery and the need to join up both employment services and skills services. And there's work that the Commission has through the 2010 review on the integration of employment skills that is specifically looking at that. But also there is a very strong sectoral dimension in terms of ensuring that whilst the delivery takes place locally, the access to work, the skills to support people, it has to be within clear progression ladders, and those make more sense in terms of sectors, so that sectors then set out what is the progression ladder of opportunity, and as Charlie said, in terms of his stores, how people can progress up through the stores with clearly defined ladders of progression. So for me, it is both. We need local delivery, which understands the world in which customers live, and those worlds can be remarkably local and small, but it's our job to go there. But to provide within that, then these sector routes that help them understand how they can progress. And through all that, I think the Commission's message is, how do we move? And it's not so much about, are we centralists or decentralists? It's about saying the customer, the individual, the employer is the most important part of this. How does everything work around them first? How do we empower them? And the systems flow from that.
Lynn, you talked about colleges being major strategic players at local level. What do you think about that wider localisation agenda?
I think that debate about how you marry up the local agenda, the local perspectives, the local system with a national framework is the one which is taxing everybody at the moment. I literally have to leave here at 11:30 to go to speak at a Cabinet Office conference that's taking place today that is about that very thing. It's looking at the examples of the total place pilots, and I don't think the skills system has actually found its way into those total total place pilots yet, but will, I think, in the next round of pilots, which are all about how do you balance and create a public sector leadership and framework in which those two can marry. And certainly the examples from the USA yesterday were actually looking at that. So I think that whole way in which localities are empowered and enabled with the agencies and the key players across every part, whether it's health, skills, police, hospitals, universities, education, the whole system that operates in regions, sub-regions, cities, etc. There are more questions than answers at the moment, but it's one of those complex emerging arenas in which everybody's putting their thoughts together, their practice, their evidence base. So I think it's a space that is rich and ripe now for, I'm not sure solutions is the answer, because I think it's different manifestations of collaborations, interagency working will occur as best response to the localities as they arise with the specific issues. So something that's happening in Surrey is going to be very different than is manifesting in Glasgow, for example. But it's how those co-created collaborative solutions form adequate, effective responses to locality needs.
Thanks, Lynn. And just a few triggers, if you would, Charlie and Brendan, that can fuel a discussion over coffee and beyond on employee share, employee ownership and related issues.
Okay, yeah, I'll go first. Well, I think employee share ownership certainly is an idea that ought to be developed much more than we've seen in our economy. But I think it's one of a number of factors that can be identified with high-performance workplaces. The ownership structure is one issue, but there are a range of other factors that bear very heavily as well on those workplaces that most effectively deliver high performance. That includes sustained investment in skills, and it includes very effective mechanisms for employee engagement and involvement too. And work done by the Work Foundation in this country, the OECD, looking at experience around the world, shows that there are these mix of characteristics. And one element of that is effective trade union representation as a positive factor linked with some of the higher performing workplaces. Now, the second part of David's question was, could more be done through the use of the leverage of pension funds, for example, to promote those models? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. I mean, again, this is an area of work in the TUC we're doing a lot more on. Now, we have a network of around 1,000 trustees of pension funds, managing funds running to the value of hundreds of billions of pounds, and there is a huge challenge to us to use that investment in a more creative, positive way to promote higher standards in a whole number of areas. The most obvious area, of course, is in terms of reward systems, and this current debate about bonuses and all the rest of it, not just in the banking and financial system, but more widely in our biggest companies, is perhaps the issue that grabs most of the headlines. But it does seem to me that this crisis has raised big questions about the way our economy is currently run, the way it's based. We are afflicted by short-termism, and that impacts not just in the banking system, but more widely in our biggest companies across the economy. The average length of share ownership is something like 7 months. As we've seen in the recent takeover of Cadbury's, in a very short time, hedge funds can move in, take up a very significant slice of the equity in a major company of that sort, with a perspective that is simply based on can they make a quick buck and a quick exit. And I think on the back of this crisis, we all need to be thinking perhaps about some of the profounder questions about the nature of ownership and the forms of leverage that we've got in our current the major companies across our economy to actually promote a different, more long-term perspective on the development of our economy in the interest of the community as a whole. And at the moment, I worry that too many of those bigger questions are being passed over too quickly.
Charlie, finally?
Yeah, and I would first of all say that I don't think employee ownership is the only way to achieve high performance at all. I think there are a number of factors which create it, and indeed I think there's a danger that it can be seen as a sort of panacea when in fact it's a bit more complicated than that. But to answer your question about why hasn't the market realised this, why aren't there more, and there are a few answers to that. And the first one is that actually the joint stock company has been very successful. If you take a 150-year-odd perspective, actually, over that time scale, it's been successful. There have been some moments in time when it's failed. And it's interesting that the partnership, John Lewis Partnership, was founded in 1929, just on the eve of the Great Depression. And indeed, I think what we're now seeing is also a failure of that ownership model in part. Some of that is to do with the short-termism around the share ownership and the way that ownership doesn't equal responsibility. The way that most shareholders exercise it is by selling the shares, and that's not necessarily about responsibility. It's not taking, actually acting as an influential owner in how the business is run. But I do think because over a long period of time it's been basically successful, it's become accepted as the sort of conventional wisdom of this is how you run companies. The ownership model of the joint stock company becomes the conventional wisdom. And it's interesting that if you go and talk to advisors, business advisors and others, they don't even have yet co-ownership on their sort of list of things they might suggest to entrepreneurs or people who are looking to get into business. There's just been a sort of very, very tunnel vision view about ownership, which I'm glad to say is now beginning to change. The second area, though, I think is to do with the way that society values, or indeed individuals, it's the difference between individual and society. And there is an element of just how much do people place on individual wealth versus the wealth of society. And that's actually, I think, been exacerbated by what we've seen recently, because the financial markets have spun in such a way is that they've enabled the creation of huge, or creation, the acquisition of huge individual wealth, which allows some people to sort of prioritise that way above other things. I think that's been a bit of a distortion, and I hope that we'll see that now unwinding a bit. And then perhaps the other reason that we haven't seen more of it is it's not straightforward. I mean, in creating effective employee ownership is not a straightforward exercise. When I hear people saying that, were they able to do so, they would change all the foundation trusts in the UK into employee-owned trusts, my blood runs a bit cold, because although I think it's a very good idea, just doing it will not achieve what people think, because it is difficult and you have to work hard at it. But that is beginning to happen. And I think one of the things I'm pleased about is there now does seem to be a much, much wider debate taking place about ownership. And what Brendan has just said, I think, is a reflection of that. I think it's interesting to reflect on this examples like Cadbury's, where had the Cadbury's family, who as entrepreneurs I think deservedly should have expected to get a rich return for the investment and the risks they've taken over the years. I think actually it's quite possible for people like that and for entrepreneurs to get a return and to see employee ownership as perhaps a very attractive and sustainable way forward for the businesses that they've created. And the financial markets are such that can be achieved. So I think it's good the debate is open. I believe very strongly that there is a real role to be played by alternative forms of ownership, and I hope that will now run and we'll see some real positive action on it.
Thanks, Charlie. Well, I'm very reluctant to stop such an interesting set of debates, but the clock doesn't, and we need to move on. So just let me give you the route map for the rest of the day briefly, if I may. We're going for a short coffee break now for 15 minutes, and then the rest of the day goes like this. The first seminar starts at 11:40, lunch is at 12:40, the second seminar is at 1:40, and we're back here for the final plenary at 2:40. So if that sounds like Virgin Trains, keep your mind on the 40s. That's what will guide us to the end of the day, all on time. And back here at 2:40 for a very short final plenary session. Let's thank the panel before we go for coffee for their insights.